This afternoon, we want to continue our study of 1 Corinthians. For the last few weeks, Brother Terry and Daniel and Jonathan have gone through chapters 8 and 9, and I certainly appreciate what a good job they did of explaining those chapters. And so tonight, we want to pick up where they left off and notice chapter 10, verses 1 through 14. Lord willing, Brother David will wrap up the rest of chapter 10 a week after next, July 9th, with the rest of that chapter. Let's begin, though, by reading verses 1 through 14 of chapter 10, which will be our text for tonight. Paul writes, "Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink. For they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with most of them God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. Now these things became our examples, to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted, and do not become idolaters as were some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Nor let us commit sexual immorality as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 fell. Nor let us tempt Christ as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by serpents. Nor complain, as some of them also complained, and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore let him who thinks he stands take heed, lest he fall. No temptation has overtaken you, except such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape, that you may be able to bear it. Therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry." Well, as I said, the brethren before me covered some difficult ground, I would consider, in chapters 8 and 9, as Paul discussed problems concerning meat offered to idols and our Christian liberties surrounding such. And the verses that we read that we want to consider tonight, I believe, are really a continuation of Paul's arguments concerning these topics. They're all summed up, more or less, in verse 14 of our text, which will serve as our title tonight, and that is to flee from idolatry. Some scholars see this passage as somewhat of an awkward sidebar, so to speak, a departure from the discussion at hand. But instead, I think Paul uses these verses to illustrate the main idea, to give credence to what he's been trying to tell them about Christian liberties. The outline might look something like this. In chapter 8, verses 1 through 6, he introduces this problem of food that's offered to idols. And then in verses 7 through 13, he talks about how this could be a danger to their fellow Christians. The liberties that they may hold may be stumbling blocks to others. In chapter 9, he began talking about his own life as an example of someone who sacrificed his liberties. Even though he had the right as an apostle to receive support, he did not do so. He used his freedom to spread the gospel. And then, of course, he talked about his self-discipline and gave athletics as an example of that, running the Christian race. Well, verses that we read in chapter 10, verses 1 through 14, use Israel and their history as an example of basically what not to do, as we'll see tonight. And then continuing on through the rest of chapter 10, he also gives an example of the Lord's Supper. And then finally ends up by giving some practical advice for dealing with this issue of food offered to idols. And so, as I said, I believe that the chapters 8 through 10 are really more or less focusing on the same topic, although certainly there are parts of these chapters that can be pulled out and applied to other things as well. But keep that in mind, that this discussion is still ongoing here. As I said, the verses that we read in our text serve more or less as a counterexample of what not to do when it comes to exercising our liberties at the expense of others. And so with this in mind, let's look beginning at verses 1 through 4. Notice that Paul begins this chapter here, this passage, with the word "moreover," or with the word "for," as other versions translate it. it ties these previous verses, or the previous verses and thoughts, to what he has to say here in this chapter. And specifically, as you can see at the bottom of the slide here, in chapter 9, at the end of chapter 9, Paul had spoken about the danger of a runner. Again, speaking of athletics and a race, and the danger of a runner being disqualified. Of course, the application there being a runner in the Christian race. It's as if Paul is continuing his thoughts now, and he wants to add another point to his argument. And so he says, moreover, or furthermore, as we might say, he says, I don't want you to be unaware, or I would not that you would be ignorant, as the King James Version puts it. Paul actually uses this phrase pretty often in his letters. It's usually when he wants to draw the reader's close attention to something in particular, something that's important. We find the phrase in other passages, other places, such as Romans 1:13, where he says, I do not want you to be aware. 1 Corinthians 12:1, I do not want you to be ignorant. 2 Corinthians 1:8, we do not want you to be ignorant. 1 Thessalonians 4:13, I do not want you to be ignorant. And so again, he uses this phrase when he wants to draw his reader's attention to something that's very important. Now, what's ironic here is the readers of his letter here, especially those who were former Jews, the Jewish Christians there in Corinth, certainly they could not have been ignorant of what he's about to talk about. Certainly they already knew about our fathers, speaking of their Old Testament ancestors. They had heard from just babes, really, the stories of their ancestors in the Old Testament. But what about the other Christians? What about the Gentile Christians? Is Paul leaving them out when he talks about our fathers? Well, that doesn't seem to be the case at all. He addresses them as brethren at the beginning of this verse. And in his letter to the church at Galatia, he would refer to the church as a whole as the Israel of God, Galatians 6:16. And so I think it's clear that Paul wanted to include, or meant to include, the whole New Testament church in this lesson from what he called our fathers, or the Old Testament ancestors. Notice Paul's use of the word all several times here in verses 1-4. In fact, 5 times he says, all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized into Moses, all ate the same spiritual food, all drank the same spiritual drink. And the point, I think, is that all of Israel enjoyed these blessings. We'll take a closer look at those blessings here in just a moment. But these blessings were universal for the whole camp, if you will, for the whole nation of Israel. Well, likewise, as Christians, we all enjoy spiritual blessings through Christ. But yet, as we'll see, that didn't keep most of God's people, most of Israel, from falling away. Even though all of them enjoyed these blessings, most, not all, but most of them fell away. And certainly the warning to the Corinthian church and the warning to us as well is clear. That we too, even though we enjoy these spiritual blessings, we all enjoy these spiritual blessings, we too must take heed lest we fall, as he will say later in verse 12. Well, let's draw some comparisons or see what comparisons it was that Paul was trying to draw between these blessings that were enjoyed by the children of Israel and the blessings that we enjoy as Christians today. First of all, he says that all Israel was under the cloud. According to numerous accounts in Exodus, such as Exodus 13, verses 20 through 22, in the Israelites' journey across the wilderness, you remember, God continually led them in a pillar of cloud by day. And this cloud, I think, represents God's leadership and His guidance and His protection. And we too similarly have God's leadership and His guidance, certainly through His Word. We have His protection, which is one of our most prized promises. Paul also says that they all passed through the sea. And this is an obvious reference to their crossing of the Red Sea on dry ground, we know, as it's told in Exodus, the 14th chapter. This represents their redemption, them being saved from Egyptian bondage. And I think the analogy is easy for us to see. As Christians, we too are redeemed. We are saved from the bondage of sin. The next comparison to me is not quite as easy to explain. Paul says that they were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. Well, first let me eliminate something that this cannot and should not mean. Some will tell us that maybe this points to the cloud and the rain falling from the cloud and how that sprinkling rain is how they were baptized. And of course, those in denominations might use this to try to back up their practice of sprinkling as a form of baptism. Well, there is evidence, I believe, that this, first of all, was not a rain cloud at all, but a cloud of smoke. You remember that it was a cloud by day and it was a pillar of fire by night. And most commentators agree that this is a representation of the Exodus, the deliverance of Israel. It's similar to what Peter wrote in 1 Peter 3 and verses 20 and 21. He says there that Noah and his family were saved through water. And then he makes a comparison to baptism, which saves us. But what did Paul mean when he says that they were baptized into Moses? Well, we can't help but remember similar words used by Paul in places such as Galatians 3 and 27 when he preaches that we are baptized into Christ. Perhaps Paul is thinking of how Moses was the deliverer of Israel, the one that led them to freedom and thus was a type of Christ, if you will. Just as this deliverance marked the beginning of Israel's place as God's special people, it's our baptism that marks the beginning of the Christian life. And of course, Christ is our leader and our deliverer. Next, in verse 3, Paul says that the ancestors all ate the same spiritual food, or meat, as the King James Version puts it. This, of course, has reference to the manna that God provided to the Israelites as they traveled the wilderness. We can read of this in Exodus, the 16th chapter. Now, the fact that it was spiritual food, I think, can simply be explained by the fact that it was provided in a supernatural way. This manna, which fell from the sky, certainly was not something that would be natural, would not come from nature, but it was provided by God. In Exodus 16 and verse 4, God tells Moses that he would provide this and that it would come from him. And when the Israelites saw the manna, they asked, "What is it? What is this?" And Moses answered, "It's the bread that the Lord has given you to eat." Exodus 16 and verse 15. Certainly this can be compared or paralleled, if you will, to the bread that we partake of as Christians during the communion. In fact, in John, the 6th chapter, and again, I apologize, I thought I had this verse on the slide, but in John, the 6th chapter, verses 31 through 35, Jesus says, the Jews said, "Our fathers ate the manna in the desert, as it is written, he gave them bread from heaven to eat." Then Jesus said to them, "Most assuredly I say to you, Moses did not give you the bread from heaven, but my Father gives you the true bread from heaven. For the bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world." Then they said to him, "Lord, give us this bread always." And Jesus said to them, "I am the bread of life. He who comes to me shall never hunger, and he who believes in me shall never thirst." And so we can see the parallel here of this spiritual bread which the Israelites ate and the bread of life that we partake of or that we're blessed with. And then finally, Paul says that they all drank the same spiritual drink. This physically or literally has reference to the water that came from the rock, again, prepared by God, given by God in Exodus, the 17th chapter, and also Numbers, the 20th chapter. But then we can compare this again to the water that Jesus spoke of, as Brother Nate spoke of this morning when he told the Samaritan woman that he could offer water where she would never thirst again. And of course, that also may have a connection or may have a comparison to the fruit of the vine, which we partake of in the Christian communion. Well, at the end of verse 4 is one of the more puzzling statements, I think, made by Paul in this chapter. He says, "For they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. First of all, what does he mean when he says that the rock followed them? Some people say that Paul was speaking here of an old Jewish legend that said that the rock which Moses struck and from which the water flowed, that that rock continued to follow them as they traveled through the wilderness, that it rolled along after them, as it were, as they traveled. Of course, as far as I know, the Old Testament says nothing about such a rolling rock, although we might wonder, what did they do for water between Exodus 17 and Numbers 20? If God only provided water for them on those two occasions, what did they do? So it's possible that perhaps that rock did travel along with them, I suppose. But I think there's a deeper meaning here. And even more puzzling is Paul's next statement, really, when he said that rock was Christ. I have to believe that Paul is using some poetic language, if you will, here. He's trying to make an analogy, using a metaphor. Wherever Israel went, God was with them, and he provided for their needs, whether that was food from heaven or water from a rock. And Jesus Christ is, of course, referred to as our rock. He's the rock of our salvation, according to verses such as Psalm 18 and 2, also Psalm 62 and 2. In the opening of this letter, in 1 Corinthians 1, Paul affirms that Christ is the source of every spiritual gift. And so I don't think we need to get too caught up in Paul's analogy here, but rather we need to make sure that his point is clear. And so what is his point then? Well, his point is this. If all of the Old Testament fathers, the children of Israel, were recipients of these privileges, these blessings, they all were under God's protection and his leadership. They all were redeemed from slavery. They all ate the same spiritual food, drank the same spiritual drink. They all had God or Christ as their provider and their leader. Likewise, we all as Christians, as I've said, have Christ's guidance and his protection and his deliverance and his redemption. But yet, that does not guarantee us a punched ticket, if you will, to heaven. Why not? Well, let's notice what Paul now says in verses 5 and 6, which I think is really the point of all these examples. Verses 5 and 6, he says again, "But with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. Now these things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted." Even though all of the children of Israel enjoyed the great spiritual blessings that Paul has just described in verses 1 through 4, God was not pleased with many or most of them. And really that's an understatement. According to Numbers 2 and verse 32, there were over 603,000 men, and I suppose that's just the men, but over 603,000 who left Egypt with Moses. You remember that of those, only two, Caleb and Joshua, actually got to enter the promised land. What happened to the rest? Well, Paul says that their bodies were scattered in the wilderness, or they were overthrown in the wilderness, as the King James Version puts it. And Paul says that the reason that he's written about these things, the reason he's reminding them of these things, is so that we, and so that the Corinthians, can learn from their example. Again, basically learn not what not to do. The lesson for the Corinthians was simply this. Failure is possible. Even though they had been baptized into Christ, even though they ate and drank of the body and blood of Christ, they had to still be careful not to fall as the Israelites did. And then Paul goes on to be more specific about how these examples are important to them. In other words, how they failed, how Israel failed. First of all, he says here in verse 6 that the root cause, if you will, the real reason for Israel's failure was their lust for evil things. This word lust comes from the Greek word for desire. James 1 and verse 14 says, "But each one is tempted when by his own evil desire he is dragged away and enticed." God gave us all desires, and he gives us a world in which those desires can be fulfilled. But God has also set boundaries within which those desires are to be fulfilled. When we try to fulfill them beyond those boundaries, we hurt not only ourselves, but we hurt other people as well. I think the devil understands our desires, and he understands the world that God has created. And so the devil tempts us by luring us and enticing us to fulfill those desires beyond God's boundary lines. The Israelites were not satisfied with God's boundaries. They were not satisfied with what God had provided. For example, they complained about the manna, the food that God had provided to them. Listen to their whining, if you will, in Numbers 11, verses 4 through 6. It says, "Now the multitude who were among them yielded to intense craving. So the children of Israel also wept again and said, 'Who will give us meat to eat? We remember the fish which we ate freely in Egypt, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. But now our whole being is dried up.'" A little dramatic there, isn't it? "There is nothing at all except this manna before our eyes." People wanted something different. They wanted something new. Just as a side note here, anytime someone starts murmuring or complaining and wanting something different and new, especially when it comes to religion, we need to be on guard. The Israelites wanted something different. They wanted something new. They wanted meat in particular, as they said here. And so God sent them quail to eat. But even while it was still between their teeth, according to Numbers 11 and 33, God's wrath was aroused, and he struck the people with a great plague. It's interesting that the place where they buried those who died from this plague, those who had given in to their lust, the place where they buried them was called the graves of craving, or the graves of desires or lust. And so I think Paul's warning here is clear. For those Corinthians who were lusting after, in this case, meats that were offered to idols, and again, that could apply to any of our lusts, anytime we try to get too close to God's boundaries, even though they knew that eating these meats offered to idols might cause either themselves or others to sin, Paul says that they needed to take heed lest they too should fall. Well, then he goes on in verses 7 through 10 to address four other sins of the Israelites. He says in verse 7 that they became, or that we should not become, idolaters as were some of them. As it is written, he says, "The people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play." So the second sin, the first being lust, the second sin that Paul lists is idolatry. And he specifically references here Exodus 32 and verse 6. This is the infamous golden calf incident. You remember that Moses, while he was away, the people gave Aaron gold and he fashioned a calf. And they began to worship the calf. And Moses came down. And this was his punishment. The Levites, it says in Exodus 32 and 28, "The Levites did as Moses commanded, and that day about 3,000 of the people died." What's interesting to me here is that Paul references really only the second half of Exodus 32 and verse 6. The people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. He makes no reference really to the first half, which is where the actual worshiping of the idol took place. Says there, "Then they rose early on the next day, offered burnt offerings, and brought peace offerings." And so to me, this seems to say that Paul didn't necessarily think that the Corinthians were actually taking part in the worship of idols. He didn't necessarily think that they would actually bow down to these idols or offer these meats and other such foods to these idols. But he wanted to make it clear to them that they're eating in this setting, that they are willing participation in these events in any way still had consequences. One commentator put it this way. He said, by saying "do not become idolaters," what Paul really means is do not, by participation in these idol feasts, seem to be idolaters. In other words, be careful of your influence. Be careful of how it might look to others. We've already talked about how Brother Terry talked about how we can be a stumbling block to others. Thirdly, Paul lists in verse 8 here Israel's sin of fornication or sexual immorality. And this, of course, we've talked about before how this would have been a common result of idolatry, how idolatry and sexual immorality went hand in hand often with the worship to these idols. Most commentators assume that Paul had in mind specifically here the incident that's recorded in Numbers, the 25th chapter. It says there that the people began to commit harlotry with the women of Moab. They invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. And the result, according to Numbers 25, is that around 23,000 of them died from a plague. Well, certainly we've already noticed in previous studies how fornication was a common problem at Corinth. And so obviously this warning would apply in a physical sense. But I think Paul's warning also applies, again, in a metaphorical sense. In Revelations, the second chapter, Jesus condemns the churches at Pergamos and Thyatira for eating things sacrificed to idols and for committing sexual immorality with false gods. That doesn't mean that they actually physically committed fornication with these false gods. But any time that we put other things, other gods, before the one true God, we are guilty, again, of immorality or of fornication, of harlotry, if you will. The fourth sin that's listed by Paul here is tempting God or tempting Christ, as he says in verse 9. And this reference is probably to the account found in Numbers, the 21st chapter, where the people spoke against God. They said there, "Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no food and no water, and our soul loathes this worthless bread." You can imagine how that must have sounded to God. God, who had done so much for them, including sending them this manna, only to have them call it worthless. To say that tempted God has to be an understatement. It's as if they wanted to see just how far they could push him, how far they could push God before he would punish them. Well, they soon found out. God, in this account, sent fiery serpents, you remember, that bit the people, and many of them died. Well, in a similar way, the Corinthians were tempting God by showing their discontentment. They weren't content to just live the Christian life. They still wanted to associate with their past by exposing themselves to the temptation here in these idols' temples. Is the same not true of us today, though? When we try to see just how close we can get to so-called gray areas, we can ride the fence, so to speak. Don't we tempt God and don't we try his patience just the same? And then finally, the fifth and the last sin that Paul lists in verse 10 is complaining. Complaining certainly was something that the Israelites were well known for. Over and over we can read of how they complained or grumbled or murmured, how they were discontent. I said no one was better at it or worse at it, I suppose we could say, than the children of Israel. Paul specifically here, I think, makes reference to Numbers, the 16th chapter, just one of the many occasions where the people murmured. But on that case, the destroyer, which was the death angel, plague was sent by God, and the death angel killed 14,700 men. And Paul warns the Corinthians that if they continue to murmur, just as many of their forefathers died without receiving the promised land, then they too will lose their promised land of heaven. Notice now verses 11 and 12. He says again, "Now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition," or our learning, "upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore let him who thinks he stands take heed, lest he fall." Paul repeats the idea from verse 6 that these things he is reminding them of concerning their forefathers, that they should serve as examples of really what not to do, as a warning about the consequences of sin. Paul warned the brethren at Rome in Romans 11 and verse 20, speaking of Israel, "Those branches were broken off because of unbelief, so don't think highly of yourself, but fear what could happen." And that's really the message to these Corinthian brethren as well. As he says in verse 12, "Take heed lest you fall." Apostasy, falling away, is a very present danger. The false doctrine that we hear so much today of once saved, always saved, is one that I'm afraid will send many souls to hell. Because if we think we are safe, no matter what we do or how we live, then we will sadly be mistaken. Thankfully, though, Paul doesn't leave us here with this scary and this gloomy picture of failure. In verse 13, he offers a hope that certainly we should cling to as Christians. He says, "No temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man. God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able. With the temptation will also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it." Paul's encouragement is this. He says, you're not the only ones who face the temptations that you're facing. Specifically, when it came to maybe the temptation to return to their old life of idolatry and also the persecution that might come along from abandoning such practices. He says, you're not the only ones that face these temptations. But this lesson applies to any and all temptations. Temptations are natural, but with God's help, we can overcome them. God does not allow us to be tempted above what we can handle. He always provides a way for us to either escape the temptation altogether or at least to endure through the temptation. Paul wrote in Hebrews 4 and 16, "Let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need." James wrote in James 1 and 12, "Blessed is the man who endures temptation, for when he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love him." And of course, the words of Christ himself, who said, "He who endures to the end shall be saved." Mark 13 and 13. Finally, Paul brings his argument against idol offerings to a climax here in verse 14, from which we get our title this afternoon. He simply says, "Therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry." The word "flee" here carries with it the idea of avoiding something by running away from it, not just by necessarily shunning it or not getting too close, but getting as far away from something as quickly as possible. I like how J.W. McGarvey puts it. He says, "If we go on the verge of what is allowable, we make it easy for Satan to draw us over the line into what is sinful." As I said, if we try to live in that gray area or sit on the fence, ride the fence, it makes it just that much easier to fall. And we must instead flee from idolatry and from all temptation, from all sin. Well, I hope that you've enjoyed the lesson tonight, the study. I certainly have gained a lot from it. We never close the service without offering the gospel invitation. If there's one here this afternoon who has never obeyed the gospel through belief, repentance, confession, and baptism, we certainly encourage you to do so tonight. Or if you've once taken these steps, but you have committed sins and need the prayers of the church, we invite you to come while we stand and sing.